This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Guess who's back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back.
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. We'll get back to Game 1 of the NBA Finals from last night in a few moments, plus some thoughts on David Tepper coming up. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand, search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. And you can always get in touch with the show online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Click on our show page, leave a comment for the show there. On Twitter at Morrow Middays. Text line 843-608-1734 or on the phones 843-721-9500 whoever joined the conversation. We'll talk with Keith Smith, who covers the NBA, coming up in about 15 minutes as well to further break down the NBA Finals. By the way, today is National Donut Day.
Whoa, really?
You know, a lot of times, one of the positives of working in radio, there's usually donuts around here. And yet today, on National Donut Day, I don't see any donuts around here.
Well, our popular donut chain over here that we usually get Krispy Kreme, they're closed because of a fire.
Really?
Apparently, yeah. So our Krispy Kreme shut down, and I don't know the nearest donut spot out here.
Well, there's Dunkin' Donuts not far.
Is it really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I think... maybe the opposite direction of Krispy Kreme. Not too far. Maybe I'll hit them up on the way home. I saw Krispy Kreme. I drove by there the other night, and they had the cones blocking the entrance, and I wondered why. I didn't know they had a fire. Jeez. Hopefully everybody's okay.
I could just move some cones and kind of drive through and say, hey, how are we doing?
Yeah, I went.
Get you back up?
Yeah, I started knocking on the door. I don't see the hot sign on or hot and fresh, whatever it is. You guys got those donuts ready? And nobody was there for some reason. Now I know why. Well, hopefully everything's okay over there, and they get back up and running soon. Because usually there's great deals. You know, it's another good one, and they're not even like donuts. They're more like desserts. You ever go to the Duck Donuts?
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Yeah, Bobby was talking about those yesterday. He likes the one with the bacon on it.
Oh, no.
No,
not the
Bobby.
One with the bacon.
Maple bacon.
Donut. No. No, thank you. I'm not a fan of that one.
That's bougie donuts right there.
Yeah, get that out. But they got some good stuff over there. Now, those aren't like real donuts. We've gotten to this area now where we have forgotten what a true donut is, and we get these they're more like cupcakes almost, and I love them. Maybe I'll go swing by Duck Donuts. I'm sure they're doing something. These donut shops, they always offer, you know, a free donut or two on National Donut Day.
I could go for an old-fashioned and a coffee right now.
Oh, let me tell you, I Googled Duck Donuts, and the photo came up of an old-fashioned, and it looks so good. National Donut Day, where to find free donuts. I'll be reading that during the next commercial break. If it's free, it's for me on National Donut Day. You kidding? So anyways, hopefully that Krispy Kreme gets back up and running. Go out and have a donut today. Who doesn't love a good donut? Fantastic. Hey, we'll get to the NBA Finals in just a moment. In that wild fourth quarter last night with the Celtics essentially stealing Game 1. And stealing is probably not even a strong enough word for it. They just took it. They conquered the Warriors in that fourth quarter. I'll give you my thoughts coming up. But you can always join the conversation, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. Let's go to the phones. Ricardo is with us. Ricardo, what's going on? How are you?
Pretty good. My nephew owns about 6 Crumble Cookies franchise.
Okay, now.
Yeah. Up in Philadelphia.
Ah. Well, see if they ship them down to Charleston for us.
That's good. What is Wawa coming here?
Yeah, now that's now you're talking. Love a good Wawa.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Real quick, I want to say I thought the Kerr got outcoached. What they did is they let Stevens shoot all his shots in the first half, and then when he got to the last quarters, he couldn't shoot. He was tired. What do you think?
Yeah, like the old Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope. They tired out the Warriors by that fourth quarter. I thought the Celtics also adjusted how they defended the screens, and they were giving a lot of those threes early. And in the fourth quarter, they were more switching on screens to smother the shooters, And that also helped shut down the Warriors. I do agree with you, though. The main point of Kerr getting outcoached, I thought going into this series, the Warriors would have a real advantage because Ime Udoka has never coached in a finals. Kerr has been here six times, and yet last night, yeah, I think Udoka in his first finals game did better than Steve Kerr, and that was a big reason why the Celtics came back and won the game like they did.
Yeah, if you look at Theis, he wasn't even guarding him at the three-point line. He backed off. So in the first period, he had like 7 three-pointers. And then in the pick and roll, they made him play defense. And soon in the pick and roll, they throw back to the three-point line. He had to run out there. So they wore him, and they focused on all the other guys and beat him up. And it was perfect. So fourth quarter, everybody was wore out and tired, and that's when they went to work. I think he outcoached Kerr. Nobody's saying that on the analyst or anything, but Kerr got outcoached.
Yeah, I agree with you. And if people aren't saying it, they should be saying it. In fact, I said it in the start of the show today, so I guess that's why you come to the Morrow Midday Show, because we know what we're doing around here. I agree, though. And the Warriors had only 16 points in the fourth quarter, and it was the worst quarter they've ever had under Steve Kerr. I do think he got outcoached. I'll circle back to that in just a moment. First, I'm not going to let it slide by. The Wawa, absolutely. Big Wawa guy. My brother lived in Philadelphia, got to know the Wawas, and then they've expanded. And when I was living in Florida, we got a bunch of Wawas down there, and it was so good. I would go there for lunch or a late-night snack too often because it was right down the road from where I lived. And I know there's a big debate, Wawa versus Sheetz, and North Carolina has Sheetz. I don't know if there's any Sheetz anywhere in South Carolina. I'm team Wawa, though, and I will die on that hill. Wawa is better than Sheetz. I've been to both plenty of times. Sheetz is solid. It's no Wawa. Wawa is so great because it's a gas station, but it's one of those, it's a one-stop shop. You can go there for any meal. The sandwiches are fantastic. They have, you want to talk about donuts? They got a fresh bakery. Love a good Wawa. I would love one in the Lowcountry here. I would go there all the time. I used to wear that place out in Florida. Anyways, I'm team Wawa. And if you've experienced Wawa and Sheetz, I hope you're team Wawa as well. Love a good Wawa. In regards to the game, yeah, as Ricardo mentioned, Theis was, dropping back. As I said earlier today, they call that drop coverage. Right, pretty self-explanatory. The big guy drops off. When it comes to a screen, there's many ways you could try to defend a screen without getting too nerdy in all of this. As I referenced earlier, when I grew up playing basketball, maybe because it's like a sign of toughness, but the idea was you always fight through the screens because the offense wants you to switch. That's part of the reason for a screen, is they want to get that mismatch. So don't give them what they want. Don't switch. Fight through it. And now, if you're going to fight through the screen and stick with the ball handler, if he's a good shooter, you want to go over the top of the screen to stay with him so he doesn't get an open shot. He may blow by you, but then you have your help defense. He's more of a shooter anyways. You'll give him the lane. You won't give him the shot. Vice versa. If the guy's not a great shooter and he likes to get to the rim and he comes off the screen and drives right to the rack, that's when you go underneath the screen because you'll give him that shot, but you're not going to give him the drive into the lane. So it depends how you defend the screen and who you're going up against. And so to start the game, the Celtics were using a drop coverage where they were going underneath, and they were giving the three-pointers to the Warriors, which seems like a very odd thought process. Why would you be giving Golden State open looks from beyond the arc? And Curry was open on a lot of those. Now, maybe that was all part of the strategy. I don't know. Like Ricardo said, you want to tire them out. I don't know. I mean, the Warriors nailed all those threes Curry did in the first quarter. The Celtics were still only down 4, so they were able to keep up. But by the time it got to the fourth quarter, they switched how they defended the screens, and they stopped giving those threes, and they took off the size off the floor. They took Robert Williams off the court and went a little bit smaller. So you didn't have that big guy that you would drop on the screen, and they were switching, and they were smothering the shooters, and the Warriors were not getting as many open looks. And Golden State did not shoot it as well, certainly after that first quarter, but obviously in the fourth quarter, they were terrible. They did not score for 6 minutes. And so the Celtics made that in-game adjustment. I would argue that they should have never defended the screens to begin with, but so be it. They still led at halftime. They still won the game, and they made a good adjustment in the fourth quarter. On the flip side, for Kerr and the Warriors, I thought they played zone a little too much. I mean, the Celtics made 21 threes. They shot over 50%. I think for Golden State, and we played that audio earlier from Draymond Green, and Steve Kerr said something similar. I think the thought was, these guys can't keep doing this. And they were hoping that that luck was going to run out, or that they were willing to just, hey, if these guys are going to beat us, they're going to beat us, right? If Al Horford's going to hit 6 threes and we lose, so be it. Because they did a great job on Jason Tatum, who is public enemy number one. And a lot of times when you go up against a team like that, you know, like if you ever face LeBron James, there's two schools of thought, but a common thought is we're not going to let LeBron beat us. Let the role players try to beat us. But we know LeBron's the star. We're going to make him give up the basketball. And if the other guys knock down shots, then so be it. They were the better team. They beat us. And it almost felt like maybe the Warriors were feeling that same way. Like, if Al Horford hits six threes, there's not much we could do about that. We're going to lose the game. If Al Horford's going to shoot that well, so be it. Right? If White makes five threes, and that was kind of what Draymond said after the game. When he said, these guys, they shot Marcus Smart as well. They're not great shooters. They shot 15 of 23. So as Draymond said after the game, we're not that worried because that's not going to happen again. And maybe it won't, but I also don't know if Jason Tatum's going to be 3 for 17 again. And so the fact that the Celtics still won that game with as bad as Tatum was, that's a huge win, especially on the road. Now, we ran through this earlier this afternoon. You can find it on demand. But I gave five reasons why I like the Warriors in this series, and yet all five probably blew up in my face last night. Number one was experience. Really didn't make a difference last night. And I included coaches, experience with the coaches. And yet, again, I think last night Kerr did get out-coached. And by the way, maybe it's just an oddity, maybe it's a coincidence, but Steve Kerr, the two times he's lost in the finals, it was to first-year head coaches. They're now facing a first-year head coach in Ime Udoka. So maybe it's kind of the unknown for Steve Kerr that he struggles with, first-year head coach, right? When you go up against, I don't know, a Spoelstra or a Popovich, you know what they like to do. When you go up against Udoka, they played each other twice in the regular season. Maybe he hasn't pulled all his tricks out of the bag. Maybe that's part of the issue. But I do agree. I think Kerr got out-coached last night. The number two reason why I like the Warriors is because they've been much better at closing out games. Doesn't that sound ridiculous to say today? They were number one in the playoffs in clutchness. The Celtics were second from the bottom in the regular season in clutchness. And yet last night in the fourth quarter, the Celtics outscored them 40-16. That was pure domination. 17-0 run to put the game away. I couldn't believe it as I was watching it. The third advantage I gave to the Warriors was I thought they were more consistent, especially their supporting cast. And yet last night, the supporting cast for the Warriors was horrendous. All they had was Steph Curry, and even he struggled after the first quarter. And meanwhile, for the Celtics, all they had was their supporting cast. Jason Tatum was horrendous, and yet Al Horford and Derek White stole the show. Now, the number four advantage I gave to Golden State was home court. They had won 11 straight at home, and yet last night blew a 12-point lead in the fourth quarter at home and lost. And the Celtics are now 8-2 on the road in the playoffs. And the fifth advantage I gave to the Warriors was this whole idea about being battle-tested. People saying, yeah, the Celtics, right, they're more tested than the Warriors. I thought that could be a disadvantage. Celtics could be more tired, more worn out than the Warriors. And Golden State has won three championships already. I think they've been plenty tested, most of those guys at least. And yet, again, last night, it looked like the Warriors were the ones that ran out of gas in the fourth quarter. And it looked like the Celtics, who have won a lot of big games this playoffs on the road, that battle testing really came into play last night in that fourth quarter. They knew what they were doing. They were locked in. That was the best they've played all postseason in the fourth quarter last night. That was huge. Now, it's just one game, and maybe it's just for the integrity of the take, but I'm not going to flip-flop that quickly. I still think the Warriors win the series, maybe now in seven instead of six. I hope we get a great series. Last night was a fun game. I'm not going to completely change my opinion, but that was a huge win for the Celtics last night, especially how they did it. The team that wins game one wins the series 71% of the time. And for the Boston Celtics, they just accomplished their mission this weekend. Game two is house money. You lose that game, no problem. You're going home tied at one. That's the goal. They stole home court advantage. Even if you lose Sunday, you go back home, you try to win the two at home, you take command of the series. And if you win Sunday and you go back home up 2-0, you are ready to command of the series. Sunday for the Celtics is kind of house money. We didn't want to call yesterday a must-win for Golden State. I hate the phrase can't lose. People say it's not a must-win, it's a can't-lose. I think we're splitting hairs. I think that's semantics. But yesterday may not have been a must-win for Warriors. Maybe it was more of a can't-lose, to borrow a phrase I really don't like. Come Sunday night, game two, that's probably a must-win. I don't think you can fall behind 2-0 heading back to Boston. Because then we'll be talking about, hey, the Celtics win both at home. They finish the series right away. They sweep Golden State. We'll see how the Warriors bounce back Sunday night in game two. When we come back, Keith Smith will join us. He covers the NBA, covers the Celtics as well. And we'll talk about last night and moving forward in this finals with Keith next. More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Intact.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Reacting to that wild Game 1 and really the fourth quarter of Game 1 in the NBA Finals last night. Joining us now to further break it down is Keith Smith, who covers the NBA. He's on Twitter at KeithSmithNBA. He's written all over the place for a lot of different people, including Celtics blog. You can find his full list of breakdowns and takeaways from last night's game. There's a lot to what unfolded last night, and Keith is with us now. Keith, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, appreciate the time. I guess to begin, that fourth quarter last night, in as simple of terms as you could put it, I mean, what happened? How did the Celtics pull that off, outscoring Golden State 40-16 in that fourth quarter last night?
Yeah, that was a really remarkable turnaround. They locked in defensively. Everything for the Celtics always starts on the defensive end of the floor. To open the quarter, Jaylen Brown put the offense on his back and said, let's go. And he created a ton of shots for himself, shots for teammates to open the quarter, continued that as the quarter went along. And then Al Horford made big shots down the stretch and just did his thing. It was really incredible turnaround where you saw kind of what the Celtics had been for the entirety of the 2022 calendar year to this point. This is the kind of team they've been, where they just lock in defensively, overwhelm you, and then they get it going on the offensive end.
Yeah, certainly. And I don't know if you can count on some of those guys and how well they shot it last night, or just the Celtics shooting over 50% from beyond the arc throughout this series. But the flip side of that, I guess you could also say, how often is Jason Tatum going to go 3-for-17? So I know a lot of people are maybe trying to discredit that performance from the Celtics, but those two facts, right, maybe kind of even each other out for Boston. What do you take away most from just those two numbers, the way the other guy shot it and maybe how poorly Jason Tatum played? What's the biggest takeaway moving forward in this series from that?
Yeah, and I don't mean to be flippant, but I want to correct how poorly Jason Tatum shot.
Yes.
Because I don't want to say he played poorly, because he had 13 assists, and he was absolutely incredible on the defensive end for most of the game. But you're absolutely right in what you said is, no, the Celtics, role players, Derek White, Marcus Smart, Al Horford, they're probably not going to shoot that well again, maybe even in the series. Maybe they might have another game like that. That's kind of how Boston's been offensively, but it's going to be unlikely that we're going to see Jason Tatum have another poor shooting night like what he had. And he has historically in his career, when he has had a bad shooting night, he usually bounces back with a really good one the next game. So that'll start to even things out, balance things off a little bit. And on the flip side, too, I think, while there's all this, being said that Boston won't shoot that well, I don't know that some of the Golden State players who are knocking down shots that don't usually do that are going to shoot as well as they did either. So I think we'll see a little bit of balancing, but it's still going to be a really competitive, good long series.
You mentioned Golden State. When it came to Steph Curry, I mean, he was on fire in that first quarter. I thought the Celtics kind of changed how they defended screens as the game went on. But what did you see? Was it more of what Boston was doing, locking down defensively? Maybe the shots just weren't falling for Curry. What happened compared to that first quarter than the rest of the game, where obviously Steph was much quieter as that game went on last night?
Yeah, I think what we saw early was the Celtics were not containing Curry off screen the way that they really want to. He was getting free, and that's not the way the Celtics played defense. They were playing guys back. The bigs were back on the screen. They also blew a couple switches. They blew one where two guys went with I believe it was Klay Thompson on a cut and left Stephen Curry so wide open he almost missed the shot, because I think he was surprised how open he was. They also blew a couple transition pickups as well. But as the game went along, they cleaned those things up. They started bringing their bigs up to the level of the ball. They started jumping him a little bit more, higher as soon as he picked up his dribble, so that way he didn't have the chances to find those passes. So they made it very difficult on him. And Derek White was a big part of their defensive effort. There was a period of the game where Derek White essentially face-guarded Stephen Curry almost the entire time. And it was like then the game kind of turned into almost a 4-on-4 contest.
Talking about last night's game with Keith Smith, who covers the NBA, I don't know if it's a coincidence or if there's something to it, that the fact that Steve Kerr, the two times the Warriors have lost in the finals, it was to first-year head coaches. Here's Kerr going up against Ime Udoka, and I thought Kerr got out-coached last night in Ime's first NBA Finals game as a head coach. What stood out to you about the matchup, not necessarily on the floor, but in regards to the two coaches last night, where you have Kerr in his sixth final, Udoka in his first finals game, and at least for game one, I thought advantage Boston last night?
Yeah, I thought Steve Kerr kind of trusted his veterans and said, all right, we know who these guys are, and he stuck with them almost a little too long. I thought Andre Iguodala, I know he made three or four shots, but Boston wants him shooting jump shots if they can get it. And defensively, he just didn't have it. He couldn't move. He hasn't really moved the same as he was. He's still an extremely smart defender and a capable defender, but you need to be more than smart and capable in the NBA Finals if you're going to stop guys like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And then I thought Ime Udoka made more changes throughout the way the game was played. Grant Williams saw very few minutes. Daniel Theis saw a few minutes in the first half, didn't see the floor. And then I thought what Udoka did of sticking with Peyton Pritchard, when the Celtics got rolling, there is almost a tendency to say, all right, I got to go back to Marcus Smart because he's our guy here. But he stuck with Pritchard for a few more plays, and then he put Smart back in when it was, all right, what we really need now is a couple more stops. And now that's what he did. And Ime Udoka's had a good handle on this team all year. He's generally pulled the right strings when he needs to and made sure that these guys are getting what they need. And he's done a really good job in these playoffs.
Yeah, he sure has. And last night certainly was a highlight. Game two comes up on Sunday. Well, first let me ask you before we look ahead. I don't know what your prediction was for this series prior to last night, but after seeing what we saw last night, does that change anything, how you look at this series? Does your expectations for this series suddenly change based off of game one?
Nothing changes for me. I picked Celtics in six ahead of the series. I thought that they have a really good chance because of the way they defend. The Warriors haven't seen a defense like this in months. And I'm not trying to knock the Memphis Grizzlies or any of the other teams that they play, but they're just not the same level of defense as Boston is. And I think you saw they wore the Warriors down as the course of the series went. But I think game two, you're going to get the Warriors' best effort because they kind of know if they go down 2-0 going on the road, it's probably over. And that is, you know, something that they're not ready for. These guys are, you know, they're not the defending champs, but they're kind of the champs, if you will, of any team left in the NBA right now. And that's why they are who they are. So I think you're going to get a really great effort. I think they'll come out, and we'll see where it goes from here. But I think the Celtics have a great chance to still get this series.
What's the biggest change that you would or we should expect for game two? I guess on the Warriors side, since they lost, you would imagine they're the ones that maybe have to make a couple of more adjustments. But, you know, what do you think we'll see differently in game two? Because as you mentioned, I mean, the Warriors, I don't know if it's too early to call it a must-win, but you can't fall behind 2-0 going back to Boston. What do you expect the Warriors to try to do differently Sunday?
Yeah, I think you'll see some different lineups from Steve Kerr. I think he'll go to some guys a little bit more, some other guys a little bit less. He might, you know, work Jonathan Kuminga in there, Moses Moody. I think their energy, I know he's been cleared to play, but I'm not entirely sure Gary Payton II is ready to play. But if he is, you know, he's somebody that we could see get on the floor a little bit there too. And then I think he may look at Stephen Curry and say, you know what, and Steph kind of alluded to this as well, is there's only six games left. It's you know, do or die, let's go. And I think we may see his minutes get pushed up as well. They generally like to keep him, you know, in that range of about 32 minutes or so per game, where he sits the first 6 minutes of the second and fourth quarters. I don't know that we're going to get that the rest of the way because I think they saw their offense really struggled when he wasn't on the floor. So those are some adjustments on the Celtics side. I think you're going to see them scrap some of those pick-and-roll coverages that they're using early in the game, go to the stuff that worked later, and stick with that.
Let me ask you, the Celtics now 8-2 on the road in the playoffs. You know, Golden State had won 11 straight at home. That's seen as a tough place to go in and win, and the Celtics won last night. The Celtics have been .500 at home in the playoffs, but what allows them to be so good on the road? I know people say defense travels, but you know, they've been so much better on the road than at home. What have you seen following the Celtics that they just seem to be an even better team away from home?
Yeah, that is part of it. It is the defense. And I think the other thing is, too, I think sometimes when they're at home, they almost it's weird because normally the home crowd lifts teams. They give them that kind of bump and that juice and ready to go. And I think sometimes for Boston, it's almost too much. And then there's a little too fired up. And then, you know, those passes, instead of being on point, they're dipping into the eighth row of the seats and those kind of things. So I think that comes with it. But I think the main thing is the team is tough. They're resilient. They fight. They're not going to give, you know, an inch. Whenever it looks really bad for them, that's when they tend to really be back at it. So it's no surprise to me that they've done as well on the road as they have. And they were also in the second half of the year, really from January 1st on, they were one of the best road teams in the entire league then too.
Before we let you go, talking with Keith Smith on Twitter at Keith Smith NBA. you know, there was a conversation that had started over the past week about Al Horford, and if he wins a championship, does that make him a Hall of Famer? I personally did not think so. But then the way he played last night, I don't know if he has a whole series like that. So my question for you, Keith, is for Al Horford, if he wins a championship this week or the next couple of weeks here and say he plays at least close to as he did last night, does Al Horford suddenly turn himself into a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, I think so. I think what gets forgotten is it's not the NBA Hall of Fame. It's the Basketball Hall of Fame. And this guy has had some success on the international level, but he has two college national championships as the best player on both of those collegiate teams. And he's going to have, by the end of this year, he'll have, or by the time it's all done, a 15, 16, 17-year career of great production. Every single year that he has played, he's been a productive player. What had always been kind of missing was that trip to the finals and in that ring. If they can get him a ring, I think it really solidifies this case, because then you have the length of the career and all that, plus the winning at the college level. I think you put it all together, and that's a Hall of Fame player.
Real quick, one last one. While we're talking about legacies, the other talking point is Steph Curry, how important this series is for his legacy. Do you view it the same way? Do we need to see something here from Steph in order to, I don't know, justify or to put him in a higher level? How important is this for Steph Curry?
I don't know. I tend to think, what are we going to do, move him from 10 to 9 all time? If we're already that high on the list, you've already had a heck of a career. There's not a whole heck of a lot that could be done. I guess if the rest of the way he scores 45 points per game and they, win this series 4-1 and he's the MVP, then maybe that does something for some people. But he's already pretty high on the list as it is. This is a guy who, when all is said and done, and really should be now, he's the greatest shooter the game's ever seen. I mean, his combination of volume and efficiency and the way he's changed the game with shooting, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 feet behind the line on a regular basis. He is the singular weapon that has driven this Warriors dynasty forward. So there's not a whole lot he needs to do for his legacy for me.
Yeah, I do agree with you there. He's Keith Smith on Twitter at KeithSmithNBA. Follow him there. Read his work. He's got the Celtics in 6 in this series. Keith, appreciate the time and the breakdowns, and enjoy the rest of the NBA Finals.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Hey, pleasure's all ours. Keith Smith, who covers the Celtics, writes for a bunch of different people, and joins us from time to time. Appreciate the time. Yeah, in regards to Al Horford and the Hall of Fame, I think the bar is the lowest for the Basketball Hall of Fame, because, as he said, it's not the NBA Hall of Fame. It's all-encompassing. It's the Basketball Hall of Fame. And so I always point to, like, Bill Walton. Bill Walton's in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Great college player, of course. UCLA during that great run. But in the NBA, he never played a full season, not once in his NBA career. He was always injured. That was the big problem. And he averaged 13 points per game for his NBA career. He's in the Hall of Fame. And I think mostly because of what he did at UCLA during the John Wooden era. And he wasn't a great NBA player. Made it to an All-Star game. But that's the, I don't know if I should say problem, but that's the big difference with the Hall of Fame. It's the same thing I always complain about, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Why do you call it the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then you're putting rappers and hip-hop? Just call it the Music Hall of Fame. Ridiculous. And so the Basketball Hall of Fame, same idea, where it's like it's all-encompassing. You put college basketball coaches, and right, because it's the Basketball Hall of Fame, not the NBA Hall of Fame. So in that sense, Al Horford, if he gets an NBA ring, he'll be one of 32 guys to win at the college level and the NBA level, plus a former 5-time All-Star. Has he been a Hall of Fame talent in the NBA? I don't think so. But you consider what he did at college, internationally as well. Maybe if he gets that NBA ring, he becomes a Hall of Famer. It's actually kind of a complaint I have with the Hall of Fame. It should just be the NBA. Keep them separate. Have the college Hall of Fame, NBA Hall of Fame. But anyways, we'll see if Al Horford, if he continues to shoot it like he did last night, he'll make a pretty strong case for himself. When we come back, some concerns about David Tepper as more negative headlines swirl these last couple of weeks. We'll get to that next. More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, are we reaching concerning territory with David Tepper? It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time. Last segment from Keith Smart, breaking down game one of the NBA Finals last night. If you ever miss anything from the show, such as that conversation, find it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. So we got the story this week, the latest, a couple of different things. David Tepper firing the coach of the soccer team he owns 14 games into his tenure. Then we get the filing for bankruptcy with the whole Rock Hill deal. And for David Tepper, you have some quick hooks. Bailing on Rock Hill pretty quickly when seemingly he wasn't getting what he wanted. Firing his coach of the soccer team 14 games into their first year. His CEO of the Tepper Sports and Entertainment announced he was leaving after 2 months, stepped down. You could even maybe say, giving Matt Rhule a 7-year contract. Maybe he wasn't all that wise. So some negative headlines, maybe some rash decisions from Tepper outside of the Rhule contract. Maybe some bad decisions by David Tepper so far since taking over of the Panthers. I saw this online that Substation in the area, in the Rock Hill area, I believe, on their sign, they said they now have the Tepper sub. We quit on it halfway through. So it doesn't really sound like a great sandwich, but pretty good jab at David Tepper. And a lot of people upset with Tepper and how things went down in upstate South Carolina. I was thinking about this. You know, a lot of times, if you're a fan of a team, say you're a Panthers fan, and you see David Tepper's buying the team. He bought the team in cash, and it was, what, like $2 billion, $3 billion, however much it was? He's the richest owner you have in the NFL. That's exciting, right? Because you need money. We've been fans, or you know somebody who's a fan of a team that's a very cheap organization. There is nothing worse than that. You need an owner. The idea is an owner with deep pockets will lead to more success. And that's often the case, which is why maybe we should start to be a little concerned about David Tepper. You ever have that friend who he's a fun time, and you say, like, wow, this guy's crazy. Right? And you go out drinking, and he's doing crazy stuff, and he's fun. He makes you laugh. He cracks you up. He's entertaining. He's a wild card. And then maybe that friend, like, never grows up, and you realize, actually, he really is just crazy. Like, he never grew up. He's not responsible. Can't hold down a job. He's out drinking all the time. He's doing crazy things. He's always breaking stuff. Same idea when you get these rich owners. Like, this is great. This guy's rich. He's crazy, right? And you love it. It's endearing because, as I said earlier, the example I used earlier, like Steve Ballmer is a wild guy. But you know what? He's bringing excitement to the Clippers. They're winning games, at least when healthy. So you look past it. But when the wins stop coming, you realize, like, actually, you know what? Maybe this guy is just crazy. George Steinbrenner was pretty crazy as an owner. He had to get kicked out of the league at one point for digging up dirt on his players. Jerry Jones, right? He's kind of a crazy guy. And when they're not winning, people get tired of the antics. And so David Tepper, you're going to be impatient. You're going to be firing people. When the Panthers aren't winning, they can't win more than 5 games, can't get a quarterback, don't know if they have the head coach. You fired Joe Brady midway through last season. Right? Maybe he's just crazy. He's a crazy guy with money, but he's really just crazy. Or he doesn't know what he's doing. So I went and I looked. The richest owners in all the sports. In the NBA, Steve Ballmer is the richest owner. I think Clipper fans are pretty satisfied. I think he's done a pretty good job. Have they won a championship? No. Have they made it to the finals? Not yet. But you get Kawhi, you get Paul George, a lot of intrigue around the Clippers team. They were not healthy this past year. If they come back healthy next year, they'll be one of the better teams in the West. The second richest owner in the NBA is Dan Gilbert. He's kind of the outlier, Cleveland Cavs owner. Now, he did bring a finals with LeBron James, but there was some bad blood there. He's regarded as kind of a crazy guy, right? Didn't really handle the departure of LeBron very well. That's the outlier in the list. Because number three, the third richest owner in the NBA is the Grizzlies owner. They were the 2 seed, led by Ja Morant. Fourth richest owner in the NBA, Denver Nuggets. They have Jokic. And they made the playoffs once again this year. They have a pretty good team. In Major League Baseball, richest owner is Steve Cohen. The Mets are in first place, largest lead in baseball. Second richest owner, the San Francisco Giants. They had the most wins in baseball last year. They're over 500 again this year. Third richest owner in baseball, the Dodgers. They've been the best team in baseball over the past decade. The three highest payrolls in baseball, all in first place. The Mets, the Dodgers, the Yankees. right? So the rich teams are winning in Major League Baseball. Now, there's no salary cap, so that's why it's really important in Major League Baseball to have deep pockets for your owner. But the NBA, rich owners having success. Major League Baseball, rich owners having success. All right, now the NFL. David Tepper is the richest owner. Hasn't had success yet. Well, maybe the NFL's different. All right, so let's look at the rest of the list. Stan Kroenke's number two. The Rams just won a Super Bowl. Jerry Jones is number three. Now, look, he hasn't had a ton of success lately, but he did bring three Super Bowls within his first, what, 6 years as owner? Let's see if Matt Rule, pardon me, let's see if David Tepper can match that. The one outlier in the NFL, Shad Khan, owner of the Jaguars. He's been a disaster. But then next on the list, the Patriots. Greatest dynasty we've had in football. So if you remove Dave Tepper, the next four richest owners in the NFL, three of them have gotten Super Bowls pretty quick. Stan Kroenke brought the Rams to a Super Bowl in his first 5 years. Jerry Jones brought the Cowboys to a Super Bowl in his first 5 years. Robert Kraft brought or helped bring the greatest franchise to NFL history, the greatest dynasty, I should say, to NFL history pretty quick as well in New England. He bought the team in the 90s. Do we have the belief that David Tepper will bring a Super Bowl to Carolina in the next, I don't know if it's a five-year window, right, in the next couple of years. I don't think the Panthers are moving in that direction. So in the NBA, the richest owners are all pretty successful. Dan Gilbert's the outlier. In Major League Baseball, richest owners are having the most success. In the NFL, richest owners are all pretty successful. Shad Khan in Jacksonville is the outlier. And so, too, maybe is David Tepper. But he's the richest owner, right? In the NBA, Steve Ballmer, Clippers are really excited about that guy. Major League Baseball, the Mets fans love Steve Cohen. He's the richest owner in Major League Baseball. And in the NFL, David Tepper, richest owner. I don't know if Panthers fans are as excited about him. Having all that money, it's only part of the battle. It's a big part. You got to have that money, and it's hard to become a billionaire and buy a team with cash that's worth billions. But that's only part of the equation. The other part is just knowing what you're doing, knowing how to run a sports team or hiring. Really, I think a good owner is one who knows how to hire talented people and then get out of the way. Because unless you played the sport, coached the sport, was in the front office, unless you've worked in sports, I don't think you really know what you're doing when it comes to running a sports team. And even great athletes, right, like Michael Jordan, part owner of the Hornets, I think he's done a pretty bad job. We've seen, you know, LeBron James is just like a minority owner right now in some teams. We'll see. Once he retires, if he becomes more involved. We'll see about A-Rod buying the Timberwolves. Magic Johnson doesn't do much for the Dodgers. But those are also not the sports that they play in. Michael Jordan is the best example of a guy who played that sport, got into the front office, you know, runs the team, still not doing great. So even great athletes don't necessarily know how to run a team. Derek Jeter did not own the Marlins, but he was the president. It was a disaster, and they fired him. So even the guys who played the sports don't really know what they're doing either. But David Tepper, just because you were successful in one area, you come in, now you buy the Panthers, you're a sports fan, doesn't mean you necessarily know what you're doing either. Haven't figured out the quarterback. Matt Rule may not be the guy. You fire Joe Brady after, you know, just a few. I don't know if Brady was ever a great hire anyways. But I was thinking about it as I was reading all the hate tweets about David Tepper and thinking, you know, a lot of the other rich guys have been successful. David Tepper is really the outlier. Because, we, you know, maybe you say, well, money doesn't solve everything when it comes to these owners. You can't just be a rich owner to have success. I would tend to agree with you. But then I look it up, right? Three of the top four owners have been pretty successful. And the outlier, Dan Gilbert, has brought a championship to Cleveland. Major League Baseball, the three richest owners are three of the best teams in baseball. In the NFL, the richest owners all brought a Super Bowl to their town in just a couple of years. I don't know if Tepper is going to do that for Carolina. So when you get these negative stories, right? Maybe there's more to it. It's exciting when somebody like that buys your team. Mets fans were rightfully excited when Steve Cohen bought the Mets. But then sometimes, like, these guys just don't know what they're doing. Or they just don't work in the sports world. They're businessmen. They're impatient. They don't get along with people. Who knows? They don't know what they're doing when it comes to making sports decisions. It was very exciting for Panther fans, I'm sure, when David Tepper bought the team with all that money. But I don't know. I don't know how excited you should be so far based off of how things have gone. Maybe he's just a really rich guy that doesn't know what he's doing when it comes to running a sports team. Hey, by the way, speaking of negative headlines, we know about the Deshaun Watson situation, everything going on there. And then I saw this headline earlier today where Deshaun Watson's attorney, Rusty Hardin, went on the radio in Houston with Seth Payne and Sean Pendergrass, and I guess he ended the interview. There's the audio. You could go find it online, where he wanted to remind everybody that happy endings to massages are not necessarily illegal. So throw that into the mix now with Deshaun Watson's lawyer defending Deshaun by saying that that's not an illegal activity. Now, I've said it all along. I'm not telling you that Deshaun necessarily should be legally punished. We already went through that process. But the NFL has suspended guys without any sort of legal punishment. The NFL, you don't need to get in trouble with the law to be in trouble with the NFL. Right? If you make the NFL just simply look bad. And I think Deshaun has really made the NFL and himself look bad. Even if you have talks of consensual sexual activity and all these different massage therapists and happy endings at the end of some of the massages and a $5,000 payment to an owner of one of these spas who, as one of the accusers stated, was then, you know, essentially like trafficking and passing women off to Deshaun Watson. A lot of bad looks in all this. All while he's in a relationship. And look, every relationship is different. Do whatever you want. Everybody's got their own kinks, whatever. Do whatever you want. But it's not a great look. And there's a reason why you don't hear these stories about a lot of other NFL guys. If it was really that common or not that big of a deal, and everybody's in the NFL is doing it. I don't know. Maybe we'd hear more stories about this. But the fact that Deshaun seems to be the only one wrapped up in this seems like, not really a great look. Not really a great thing. Some of the things they're detailing may not be illegal. Still doesn't mean that's what you want one of your employees doing. Or in the case of like the Cleveland Browns, your franchise quarterback doing. I'd be curious to see what the suspension, I say this every day, curious to see what the suspension will be for the NFL. I wouldn't be surprised if it's harsh because there's a lot of negative storylines to all this. And even if there's no legal repercussions, still, you're making the NFL look bad. And the NFL would then look even worse by not doing anything with more and more of these stories coming out. And Rusty Hardin defending his client, but also at times kind of putting his foot in his mouth with some of the admissions. We'll wrap up your Friday next. It's the More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Yo, what up?
What's the word, big fella? Everything's good on this end.
Hey, Luke, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Luke. Hey, man. Pleasure to be on your show.
I'm doing great, but I'm hoping you could call me Boca Baby.
Great show. You're doing a good job.
Hey, you're turning into rapidly my favorite person I've interviewed with, and I've done like 50 of these in the last week.
You've done your homework. I like it. I absolutely like it. I love that.
Another great thought.
You've done your homework, haven't you? Good job.
You're always getting these big stars and important people on. That's great to hear. We like to hear the interviews.
You know, it's uncanny how you do this, Luke. And I don't know how you do. Because, I do this gauntlet of radio on Thursdays where I do all these different cities. Many of them need their hosts to have me give them some talking points. You hit all my talking points every week. It's uncanny how good you are.
Always great talking football with you, Luke. Appreciate you guys being right.
Very impressive.
Just want to say, I find you the low country Colin Coward. You use common sense with statistics, and you combine them, and you think outside the box.
Shout out to all the people in Tulsa that support the show.
Tell your friends. Tell your friends.
Da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. Go ahead, boy. That's how you bring it on.
Is this a sports show or a dancing show?
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what we're doing around here.
Lunch with Luke for 3 hours, anything goes.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Wrapping up your Friday on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcasts. And you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Stream us online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through TuneIn Radio, your smart speaker, or our free app. Search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. Download that free app. And through the app, you can listen to the show live or on demand from anywhere in the world. The podcasts are available there. ESPN Charleston in the App Store. Download it today. Appreciate listeners checking in from at least 8 different states and multiple countries on this Friday as we head into the weekend. Whatever happens this weekend, of course, we'll be here to break it all down on Monday. Don't forget about the summer golf tour, Monday morning, 8 a.m. It goes live at charlestonsportsradio.com. It goes very quick, so make sure you're ready to go to get one of those foursomes. I think the Warriors do bounce back in game two. They opened as a 3.5-point favorite, and the number has only gone up, so everybody seems to be on Golden State early on. But it's hard to see them losing both at home and falling behind 2-0. Now, the Celtics have been really good on the road, but this is as close to a must-win you'll find in Game 2 of a series for Golden State. You cannot fall down 2-0 heading back to Boston. I think they win Sunday. I think it's a fun series, and we'll be here to break it all down again on Monday. If you missed anything from the show, catch on demand. ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. Life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we say goodbye. We'll say hello again Monday at noon. Enjoy the weekend. It's the More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.